Good afternoon and welcome to the Eco News Report, a production of the North Coast Environmental Center in conjunction with KHSU, located on the campus of Humboldt State University. I am Raina Nanayel, your host for the Eco News Report. I am Executive Director of the North Coast Environmental Center, and we are really excited today. We are joined today by Bob Hunter. He is a board of directors for Water Watch of Oregon. He has also been the staff attorney for Water Watch for some 13 years. He is now retired. We are also joined today by Gary Graham Hughes, Executive Director of EPIC. We're going to try to have a conversation about Klamath issues because of recent release of the draft EIR and EIS. We wanted to start talking with folks about the history of the Klamath agreements and what some of the major concerns are with the agreements, draft EIS, EIR, and just informing the public about the importance of their involvement and response to these. So thank you so much, Bob, for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
Mm-hmm. Gary, likewise, thank you.
Well, thank you, Rain, for having me. I'm really glad to be with you on the Eco News Report, KHSU.
Let's start by talking about some of the history of the Klamath agreements.
Just maybe a little bit of background on some of the agreements. They sort of were developed through negotiations that were going on in the FERC process related to PacifiCorp's relicensing of PacifiCorp dams on the Klamath River. And negotiations eventually morphed a bit away from just talking about removing the dams and then got into other basin issues such as water issues and refuge issues and flow issues that are unrelated to dam removal. But the Bush administration at the time saw the carrot of dam removal as a way to perhaps deliver some things that were on its agenda to deliver to the Klamath Project, which is a federal reclamation project, to the irrigators in the Klamath Project. And so what eventually came out of the process were two agreements that are linked together, one the KBRA, known as the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement, and the other the KHSA, the Klamath Hydro Settlement Agreement. In terms of some of the issues that the KBRA deals with, basically the parties to the negotiations were required to try to resolve and meet some of the demands by the Klamath Project irrigators, and they had a few things that were very important to them. One was water security. Two was a continuation of power subsidies that they had enjoyed for many, many years, and other subsidies in terms of the agricultural production. And the other was wanting to continue to make sure they preserve the right to commercially farm 22,000 acres of Tule Lake and Lower Klamath National Wildlife Refuges. And basically, they were able to achieve their goals through the KBRA. And then on the power side of things, PacifiCorp had some concerns in terms that it not be responsible for actually removing dams if dams were going to be removed, also wanting to make sure that its shareholders did not bear costs of dam removal. So that agreement was put together to serve some of PacifiCorp's needs in putting dam removal out into the future, not requiring strong interim measures in the meantime, and allowing PacifiCorp an opportunity to recover some of the removal costs from ratepayers by continuing to operate in the interim. So that's kind of the gist and a little background on some of the two agreements.
Let's talk about why FERC decommissioning wasn't or was thought not to be accomplished. Why folks and tribal folks thought that making an agreement was important, why they thought that FERC decommissioning might not happen, and talk a little bit about Section 401 of the Clean Water Act.
I do know that the 401 permit issue is of great importance, not only when we speak of what happened in the past or what could happen in the future, it's the fact that it's in abeyance right now, that PacifiCorp is being granted total relief from the requirements of the Clean Water Act as the situation now stands on the Klamath River.
And I guess the other important point that's been raised by some people who might have a dissenting opinion because of the economic factors, what's being avoided here economically, is that there are many other dams up for removal. So what kind of precedent does this set? That point has been brought up, and I think that that's a fairly strong point. It's not just the Klamath Dam. We have many dams all over the U.S. that might be coming up upon this same process. So if we continue to, you know, cut deals, what kind of precedent does that set? So do you have a sense, though, Bob, historically and in the community of why there was so little confidence in FERC or the effects of Section 401?
Well, one can never predict what's going to happen in any regulatory processes, and they're subject to a lot of political pressures as well. But I think what we do know, and that is that it would be very difficult in California for PacifiCorp to get a 401 water quality certification for the operation, continued operation of their dams. So one thing they did achieve in this negotiation is basically they, in a sense, have, through these agreements, got over a decade of essentially a 10-year license without having to comply with 401 certification and without having to do any meaningful interim measures. They've already sort of accomplished at least a partial renewal of their license, in a sense, because they're getting annual renewals right now. Now, whether or not the FERC process would lead to dam removal, it's a very difficult thing. But I think the better point to make is that there's tremendous leverage in the FERC process and in the 401 certification process to actually get a deal with Pacific Corps for dam removal. Now, of course, an agreement was reached, KHSA, which wasn't really an agreement to remove dams, but an agreement to study whether or not dams should be removed. And that's part of the EIS process that's now being conducted, is to determine whether or not the dams should be removed. And of course, removal of dams is something we think is really imperative and a key and a cornerstone to restoring the Klamath Basin, and is something that could have and should have been supported in the FERC and water quality certification processes, and should be something supported in the CIS process as well. But I think the point is that the current agreement that we have has some issues with it, and I think one of the largest issues, it's been linked with the KBRA. So you don't get dam removal under this arrangement unless you get authorizing legislation and funding for the KBRA. And some folks, you know, supported this as a way maybe to push dam removal ahead, because you would be getting Klamath Project irrigator support, and at least the prior point in time, the Bush administration support in the states of California and Oregon supported the KBRA. But I think one needs to question that in light of the current economic situation in this country, whether tacking a almost billion-dollar deal onto dam removal when none of that, those funds are actually part of dam removal itself, and where there's also some important conservation interests dealing with flows for salmon and steelhead and suckers, and dealing with issues such as commercial farming on the refuge, that sacrificing these conservation interests and asking the taxpayer to pick up huge subsidies is something that is going to further dam removal, which is controversial enough even without coupling it with the controversies in the KBRA and the big financial burden of the KBRA.
And I have heard some folks argue that the dams will have to come out anyway, because Pacific Corps is going to be looking at a tremendous amount of debt here, or a tremendous cost with any kind of introduction of fish ladders and all of the compliance required to reassert. So what can you tell us about that? That's a prominent argument that I hear in the community, that the dams will have to come out anyway because Pacific Corps can't get Section 401. You know, they would never be able to accomplish many of the requirements.
Well, again, I think the point there is that there's tremendous pressure and leverage that can be exerted on Pacific Corps in the FERC water quality certification processes. And then the other issue that Pacific Corps faces is if they know, even if they got a license to continue to generate power at these facilities, they would have to provide basically fish ladders and screening and provide for volitional passage. That was determined by the strong requirements that were proposed in the license by the federal agencies. And so that is a huge cost they would be facing if they intend to keep the dams. Now, Pacific Corps doesn't necessarily worry about picking up that cost as long as they can pass it on to ratepayers and also maybe then receive a income stream from the increased capital costs. But they run a risk that the Public Utility Commissions of California and Oregon might not approve of that if there is a cheaper alternative, such as dam removal. And if that was the case, then their shareholders would be stuck with the bill, and that's something that Pacific Corps doesn't want to risk. And that, again, is a reason that Pacific Corps ultimately should want to make a deal to remove the dams and to have the dams removed. And so I think even though we have one agreement out there right now, it isn't the only deal that can be made to remove these dams if for one reason or another it should fall apart because of its linkage to the KBRA.
Gary, maybe you can enlighten us about the Merkley legislation a little bit and talk about that briefly. But it's maybe important to say that one of the strongest arguments for the agreements is that there's an uncertainty about FERC actually removing the dams, that perhaps there's even an uncertainty about whether Pacific Corps would be able to pass the cost of relicensing onto the ratepayers. So given that, what does that really say about our federal and our state processes that many resource professionals, scientists, and tribes have so little faith in the regulatory processes that they are willing to bargain with water rights to some extent and provide water for irrigators before water for tribes and that kind of thing? Some have called that a sort of agreed upon termination. Do they have a point in this? I mean, is there so little faith that this will happen? Is there a way that we can understand that? Or do they have a point? Would the process fail? Would it fall down? Are we on the verge of losing ESA? You know, are we on the verge of losing regulatory protections that we have for the environment?
Well, I don't actually have an answer to that because it seems a little bit cynical, the question that you're presenting, though it also has a lot to do with the realpolitik that we're trying to respond to these environmental challenges. The FERC process, I do want to delve into this a little bit more, but it's not just the Klamath that's at stake here. We're talking about rivers all across the western states that are plagued by antiquated and obsolete hydroelectric or other types of dams. And it's really important that these rivers get the attention that they need, and taking a good look at what kind of precedent could be set here is very important. And when we get to the questions of corporate accountability and the fact that PacifiCorp is basically armoring themselves from really having to take on responsibility for the financial burden of managing these facilities could bode very poorly for a number of other rivers across the West. One comes to mind is the situation with the Snake River and four dams on the Snake, and ultimately how challenging it might be to restore these rivers if it's a bankrupt government that's being expected to foot the bill.
Just from your experience, Bob, what have you had in terms of discussions with Oregon Wild and Water Watch of Oregon? Because I know that you both have worked on this for some time. Have you had in-depth discussions about corporate responsibility and what might work?
Well, I know the sort of the precedent this deal sets was a strong concern to our organizations, and I think Friends of the River also had some very big concerns about responsibility of a license holder for decommissioning projects and that kind of thing that is being passed on to ratepayers and the federal government and other entities here. And so I think that's one precedent there should be at least some concern over, but I think even a larger concern some of us have from the conservation community is this idea of sacrificing unrelated conservation interests in the case of these deals, river flows for salmon and water for refuges and farming in the refuges are being sacrificed to build political support for dam removal. And I think that's a dangerous precedent to go out and find unrelated conservation issues to basically trade to build political support for dam removal. I think in a dam removal negotiation, one should be concerned about addressing issues directly related to the dam removal and bargaining with those instead of bringing in unrelated issues to try to resolve and use the carrot of dam removal to get people to sign off on other important issues.
I do think they are a little bit more related, perhaps, Bob, than you're allowing for. Remember that we're speaking about the potential and probable removal of four obsolete hydroelectric dams in the main stem of the Klamath, but there's actually a fifth dam, the Keno Dam, that would remain, and there's still a lot of questions that surround what kind of flows would be permitted out of this structure that would essentially continue to control the river. And the flows that come out of that structure are directly related to the interests of the irrigators. So I definitely see the concerns about expanding political agreement on beyond the focus at hand. That's clearly, there is a lot of substance to the fact that there's a lot of different stakeholders in this basin who have a great interest in how the water is managed, how the water is allocated.
Well, I agree that there are a great many people have a great interest on how the water is managed, but we should understand that none of the dams are the dams that are storing water for irrigation. So by removal of these dams or maintenance of these dams, it doesn't decrease the amount of water overall available. The whole water management issues, though, managed there at the lower end of Lower Klamath Lake. What Keno Dam does is it raises the impoundment up there so that they can basically get water in a way that minimizes pumping. But that won't be affected by dam removal. So in the sense of negotiating for removal of dams, neither water supply or even the electric rate is affected by these removal. So though there's other issues that stakeholders have, neither of those issues are affected by whether the dams stay in or out and are of not any concern to PacifiCorps, the dam's owners. So from that perspective, none of those issues need to be addressed in a dam removal agreement.
So you just made the argument that the dam removal aspect of the agreements has very little to do with water for irrigators or restoration of the basin or water for fish or anything like that. Dam removal is dam removal because it's not storing water for irrigators. And the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement was something that was a deal tacked on to provide water for irrigators. And that is a guaranteed amount. What is it? 330 CFS in dry months and 380.
So it's 330,000 acre feet in low water years going up to 385,000 acre feet in wetter years, and then that lower end dry year amount will bump up from 330 to 340 once the dams are removed. So basically, the reason the farmers like the KBRA in the project, or the irrigators, is because that 330, 340 low season, what they call a limitation, and that's the other thing that's kind of misleading, I believe, to the public, is that it's being sold that the farmers are giving up 100,000 acre feet from what they historically used in dry years, and this is a limitation on their diversion, and because of that, we need to give all these subsidies for the water plan and power and so on and so forth. But those limitations are more than limitations. First off, the 100,000 acre feet that is being touted as a reduction, what they did is they took 1 year, which was the highest water use ever in the project, which was 430,000 acre feet, and said we're reducing that to 330. But in most other years, it wasn't nearly that high. But the real point is that 330 floor is more water than they currently would get under current ESA regulation, that is, regulation under the Endangered Species Act to provide adequate flows for listed coho salmon in the Klamath River.
This is one of the main issues for people who have problems with the agreements. And it's a valid concern. If you speak to tribal members, if you speak to proponents of the agreements, they might say, we'd love to have more flows than were negotiated in the deals. So this is one of the main concerns. How much water is in the Klamath for coho, which are on the brink? How much water and clean water is available in Klamath Lake and various other places in the Lost River for suckers? These are the issues, and people are concerned about the deal that's been made for the irrigators and the fact that their water right comes first. It's a guaranteed water right. So this is one of the main issues. So let me break for just a moment and remind people about where they can get more information about the upcoming information session that's being held. It's called Klamath River in the Balance, Decoding the Federal Dam Removal Process. And this event is intended to inform the public on issues related to the recently released draft EIS, EIR, but also to give people a background on the very complex history in the Klamath and the people involved. It's going to be Wednesday, October 19th. It's coming right up. It'll be held at the Warfinger Building, 1 Marina Way, Eureka. It'll be 6:30 to 8:30 p.m., but I believe doors open at 6. It's sponsored by the Redwood Chapter Sierra Club, North Coast Environmental Center, Environmental Protection Information Center, Water Watch of Oregon, and Redwood Chapter Audubon Society. So if you can come out to that, it's going to be a precursor to some of the forums and public hearings that are going to be held, which we also encourage you to go out to. I believe that in Arcata, one is being held on the 26th. So this will be a place where you can hear presentations by Bob Hunter and various other people to get a sense of what's going on in the process and what's happening with the Klamath, and then also at the public hearings, you'll get a lot of presentations and information provided. So we would encourage the public to attend all of these events. That's October 19th at the Warfinger from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. That's Wednesday.
Yeah, and I'd like to elaborate a little bit on why the Environmental Protection Information Center made a decision to assist in bringing this event together. And it's very exciting to participate with this coalition of local groups and as well Water Watch of Oregon. We find that the series of public hearings, there's going to be six of them actually throughout the Klamath Basin. Well, Arcata's not in the basin. I think the Arcata event for October 26th at the Arcata Community Center, it's 4:30 to 8:30. This is a public hearing and comment event that's being hosted by the Department of Interior. This will clearly be an event that the public can hear straight from the government agencies that are responsible for the development of this draft plan, what the benefits of the plan will be. And it's very clear, and everyone across the board knows that all the science says that the benefits of removing the dams for the salmon are enormous, as well as other species native to the ecosystem. When we saw the upcoming series of public hearings, we really felt that it was going to be important to ensure that there was an opportunity for other voices to be heard, voices that haven't had as much access to the process, and therefore, in the framing of the message that, you know, the proponents have developed for advocating for the plan, we really wanted to make sure there was another opportunity for voices to be heard in order that the public really gets a chance to hear from all the people who are interested in this issue. And that's why, Bob, it's really an honor to have you from Water Watch of Oregon coming down for this event because of your depth of experience in the basin, more than 30 years studying the upper basin, and the importance for those of us who are down here towards, you know, the ocean mouth end of the river to be really tuned in to what's going on in the upper area as we make an effort to provide informed comments to the government about this process.
That is definitely the intention. I know for Sierra Club and for all of the sponsors of this event, you know, we really, our intention is to help people to actually comment, to make comments, whether, you know, they can decide for themselves, but to make informed comments to help kind of narrow that down. But like Gary said, to make sure that everybody's voice is heard, including dissenting voice, and that issues that are very real, which is how I'd like to wrap up our time here, is to really nail down what the key issues are from the perspective of people who think that the settlement agreements are not beneficial to the Klamath River and are maybe problematic. So I'd like to kind of wrap up with that. And I can start. One thing that we haven't mentioned is the social justice issue related to Hupa. And although that is definitely in the reins of the Hupa tribe and they are more than capable of handling that themselves, it is appropriate to maybe add that as a result of this, if this agreement goes through, they will not any longer be able to be represented by the Department of Justice if they have a water right claim or a litigation against the government for a breach of water right. So that's something to talk about. There's definitely an issue with water availability for the refuge, or potentially if you're going to embark on some sort of major deal for conservation of the upper basin, and we have less than 10% of our wetlands in California remaining, wouldn't it make sense to restore much of the refuge up there to wetlands? So there's a couple issues right there, and then, of course, flows.
Well, just maybe stepping back, and if one looks at what are the essential elements for Klamath River Basin restoration, and then kind of look at these agreements and see whether they get there or not. And, of course, one of the essential elements is removal of the lower four dams on the Klamath owned by PacifiCorps. And I hope that everyone will support that element and support the EIS and its recommendation to remove those dams. But another equally important component for river restoration is making sure there's assured minimum river flows or minimum quantities of water for fish based on the best available science. And so the question is whether or not these agreements assure those flows. And the reality is the only insurances and commitments in the KBRA are for irrigation water, where fish get what's left over. So the agreements predict what flows might be left over for fish, but they do not assure water for fish, nor analyze what fish need, not just coho salmon, but the entire fishery.
The argument against that is that, hey, there's still the ESA. We still have to comply with ESA, but can you talk a little bit about how much lag time that would involve and what we might lose?
To me, that's a little disingenuous. because it has been the ESA that has been protecting these flows to date, other than when science was manipulated in 2002, but then litigation kind of overturned those decisions. In 2002, of course, we had the bad fish kill. But it's kind of funny because proponents of the agreements will say, well, we've got the ESA to protect flows. But at the same time, the whole agreement is designed to deliver regulatory assurances under the ESA to the farmers at their guaranteed water level. Even though the agreements say, well, ESA still applies, the agreement itself requires folks to try to deliver that. So instead of trying to do science or say, okay, what do fish need and provide that and then see how much water is left over for irrigation, they flipped it back again. You know, historically, farmers just took their water first, fish got what's left over. Then when the ESA kicked in and when tribal trust rights were being asserted by the federal government, it kind of turned things on its head. And now the design of the KBRA is to, again, have it go back to where it was before ESA, where basically irrigators get theirs first, fish gets what's left over, and we try to give regulatory assurances so the ESA doesn't get in the way, and we get tribes to waive their reserved water rights and the government to waive its tribal trust duties to get around that pressure that kept farmers from getting their water first.
And you make an excellent point there. I think that is a very strong point. It is, at the very least, a huge concern. It's something that the public should look into for themselves. They should get as much information as possible. They will be able to hear more about this at the upcoming event. It is called Klamath River in the Balance, Decoding the Federal Dam Removal Process, and it is a very complex process, but you make an excellent point there. It seems that we do have a trend where water for irrigators, water for, you know, anthropocenic uses takes precedent over habitat restoration. We are definitely in a political cycle where economics prevails and environmental concerns, which is the basis of all economics, take a backseat. That's what's very concerning to me. And as environmental organizations, we have EPIC represented here, North Coast Environmental Center. We have Water Watch of Oregon. Our primary duty is to speak for the voiceless, and that would be the organisms and the ecosystems that are taking a back seat to economic interests. And we definitely have a clear sense of that here, if nothing else, because an agreement was made, because there was so little faith in the regulatory process. I would like to remind people that all of the organizations involved in this are favor dam removal. Everyone agrees that dam removal, as has been said, is in the best interest of the river and the organisms. So I wanted to open it up to brief last comments.
I do have a couple last comments, Rain. Thank you so much for having us here today. It's really an honor to be representing the Environmental Protection Information Center here. And I often am having to take myself on beyond the Klamath when I dig into this issue. And if there has been one lesson from all of this work recently, looking at how divisive this issue has been, how divisive the agreements have been, the controversy that's arising out of it, the lack of unity amongst environmental interests and all these different actors in our community here, it teaches me how destructive hydroelectric development is. And the fact that we are right now on this planet facing an explosion of massive hydro development on rivers all around the world, this issue in the Klamath should be a clear sign to everyone that hydro is dirty energy, that there's no way to get past the fact that you cannot save the lungs of a planet that's suffering from climate change by cutting her arteries.
Mm-hmm.
And as this issue goes on and the struggle to get dams removed and people being all across the rainbow as far as how they are divided on this issue, it just drives home the fact that dams destroy communities. And
Bob, would you like to make a last brief comment?
Yes, we really need to get these dams out of the Klamath River if we want to restore Klamath River salmon. But even with the dams gone, we're still going to need adequate flow and high-quality flow for salmon to survive in the basin. And what's happened over the course of time is we just grew irrigation to too large a level. You know, the Klamath Irrigation Project irrigates approximately 235,000 acres, whereas there's off-project irrigation in California and Oregon, about another couple hundred thousand acres, where basically in total we're irrigating over 500,000 acres, and we can't pull that much out of the system and have healthy flows and clean water.
And groundwater.
And so the best way to address that is through a willing seller buyback program where we bring irrigation to a level that's sustainable in the basin. And unfortunately, that's a big failure of the KBRA. It tries to sustain the irrigation at something that is not sustainable if you want to have a healthy river environment and healthy refuges.
Thank you so much, Bob. I want to thank very much Gary Graham Hughes from EPIC for being with us, and I am deeply honored as well to have Bob Hunter. If you would like to hear more about this, we're going to have the event on Wednesday, October 19th at the Wharfinger from 6:30 to 8:30. Thank you so much both for being here.
Thank you.
This has been the Eco News Report, and my name is Raina Nonale. I've been your host for the past half hour. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call our listener comment line at 826-6089. You can hear this broadcast again at the KHSU website under archive programs at khsu.org. The Eco News Report is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. Thank you to our engineer, Fred McLaughlin. Please join us again next Thursday at 1:30 p.m. here on KHSU for the Eco News Report.